Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I speak to fund manager Jeremy Deal, based out of Amsterdam. And Jeremy and I connected only a few weeks ago, but through a contact, an investor who you probably all know, which is Guy Speer. I've kind of been pestering Guy to see if he can come on the podcast for an episode. Hopefully we'll get that across the line one day here soon. But he did say that in the meantime, you know, I've got this great friend, Jeremy Deal, who would be fantastic to speak to on a podcast. And Jeremy does have a really fascinating approach to investing. He initially started out like many value investors do, discovering the world of Buffett and Ben Graham and intelligent investing and so on. And over time, he's transitioned more towards taking what he describes as a private equity type approach to investing in public markets. He invests in a fairly concentrated fashion. He intends to hold businesses for a long period of time. And he kind of views the world and the investment business a little differently from most people. He's not necessarily analyzing financial statements in the very traditional Ben Graham type way. He's really trying to understand what is the total addressable market of a business, what's the competitive advantage that a business has, and if he can identify a situation where you know, those two aspects are really, really misunderstood, it can potentially create long-term investment opportunities. And one of the examples that Jeremy shares in this episode is a business called Spotify, which I'm sure you all know. So as well as Jeremy's investment philosophy and his investment in Spotify, we also talk through some of the sort of mental frameworks that Jeremy has in place to be a long-term investor and to be able to stomach maybe short-term underperformance in order to achieve long-term outperformance. And towards the end of the episode, we also talk briefly about his relationship with Guy Speer. So I do hope you enjoy this episode, but without further ado, let's roll this one with Jeremy Deal. Jeremy Deal, welcome to the podcast. We connected relatively recently, only in the past few weeks, but through a mutual contact actually, which is Guy Speer, who I've been pestering for a few months now to try and get on the podcast. And he eventually gave me a date, but he said, this guy Jeremy Deal would be great to talk to in the meantime. So
thanks for having me, Tom. I love your podcast. You have some great interviews. I think you recently interviewed Matt Peterson, who's also a really good friend of mine. But yeah, it's very nice a guy to connect us.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
Thanks for staying up late tonight. I know we're about 12 hours apart in time zone. So I guess it's the global economy we live in today. So in full effect.
Yeah, for sure. It's about 9:45 at night for anyone listening, but I'm caffeinated and I'm ready to go. So
me too.
That's great. We had a call a few weeks ago. It was only about 30 minutes or so, but I kind of came off that call with a very long list of topics, which I think you have quite a different perspective on compared to the typical investor that I've had on the podcast before, or that I've kind of come across. And I know you're a little short on time here, so I'm kind of keen to dive right into that. But maybe before we do, give us a brief bit of background on yourself and how you got into money management.
Sure. I mean, I've been interested in investing as long as I can remember. I think the very first book that created that interest for me was Making of an American Capitalist, one of the stories of Warren Buffett, but the story of Warren Buffett focused more on his private equity portfolio, so to speak. I know a lot of value investors have a similar, you know, kind of history of where they read something about Buffett or they went to a Berkshire Hathaway meeting. It was very similar for me. And I read Graham and I started thinking about, it was just clear to me that most stock investors don't think about the stocks if they're buying the whole business. And that was the message that Buffett had, was whether you're buying a public company or a private company, you need to think about kind of, do I want to buy this stock? Because I would buy the whole company. And if I want to buy this whole company, like, what am I actually buying here? And what is my duration? And am I going to own this for 20 years? What is that business? What are the advantages that business needs to have in order for me to justify owning it for 20 years versus buying something else? And so I was always fascinated with those principles. And that led me to just an explosion. It was like finding religion. Like, wow, this makes so much sense to me, more so than anything I'd ever read. But I'm from Southern California, And in Southern California, it's just there's not a very big industry for this business, especially in San Diego, where I'm from. And so after college, I kind of looked around for jobs in the industry, but they were few and far between. I actually only found one or two real hedge funds or investment funds, maybe one or two private equity funds in the whole city. I couldn't find anything. I wanted to stay in the city, so I ended up ultimately working for an entrepreneur who had sold his company to Honeywell, and the business was being integrated into Honeywell. And it felt like a really good opportunity to learn about business. And I thought, well, if anything, I could translate this to investing and learn about business from the ground up. And he was a great mentor. It was a small division of a big company, but it was run autonomously. And I learned a lot about a lot about business. It was a manufacturer. It manufactured and designed wireless home security equipment. But again, very entrepreneurial business, and every day was kind of day one. And ultimately, he invited me and a handful of other people to join him in a startup competing with the division of Honeywell that we worked for. And so money, we raised money. He raised money. I guess I didn't. I was the junior guy that just was along for the ride. And it was a very interesting experience. Ultimately, the business was sold a few years later to a private equity fund. And that whole time, I had just spent my evenings and weekends, studying stocks, studying private companies, just traveling and meeting management teams. Just really talking to other managers, just anything I could in the industry. Just every day that went by, even though I was part of this private business, it just felt stronger and stronger, this gravitational pull towards running a fund. And just when the time came, when the business was when the business was sold, gave me a little bit of financial runway to go off my own and see what I could, and start a fund. So ultimately, we started looking at private companies because it was during the financial crisis. But that evolved into just instead of looking only at private companies where we thought there was a potential opportunity, it evolved into investing in public companies.
Very cool. And one of the things you mentioned the first time we spoke that was that you take sort of a private equity type approach to investing in public markets. And I think you even mentioned you sort of paid a little bit of attention to what Buffett was doing and sort of private equity type investments as well. Can you maybe speak to that a little bit?
Well, what I learned from Buffett, I mean, everybody kind of takes something different away. But what I learned from him was to look at a stock like you're buying the whole business. And that doesn't mean you need to steal the company for 5 cents on the dollar. It just means that, you need to have that perspective of, hey, I'm gonna make an investment. And if you're gonna buy if you're gonna buy the whole business, you usually don't buy it to flip it in 3 months or 1 month or even a day. You look to, hey, what is the business going to look like in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? And I think he also recognized that the longer you hold a great business, the more money you make in the long tail. And the exponentiality of the return just goes up the longer that business can maintain its competitive advantage and continue to grow. And so that became just instilled in me early on. I don't know if we actually practiced that in the beginning of the fund, in the early days of the fund as much, but it's easier said than done to invest for 3 to 5, 3, 5 or 10 or 20 years out in the future. But that's more or less what happens in private equity. In private equity, even a typical fund is 5 to 7 years. Maybe there's an extension, and you when you make the investment, you're not looking to trade it necessarily overnight. And maybe there's some games in traditional private equity played with IRR and debt and return of capital and a massaging of the return. But the most successful private equity investing is done by making a bet on the next, it's called medium to long-term future of the business. And so we just translate that into stock investing, which I don't think is rare or unusual today. At least we've seen some of the best businesses of the world continue to compound and grow at rates that I think people have been shocked by. Even just taking valuation aside, just looking at the free cash flow generation and the earnings growth of some of the best businesses in the world over the last 15 or 20 years has been pretty astonishing. And putting that all together means that if you want to capture that long tail potential of a great business, you need to have a framework to be able to own it long enough to capture that.
Yeah, interesting. One of the things I often struggle with is particularly when trying to buy into, I guess, what people might call these long-term compounders. And I know when we spoke the first time, you said you didn't want to come across as a compounder, bro. So we will avoid labeling you as such. But one of the things I've sort
I
of
guess there could be
struggled with.
worse things to be associated with,
There
but
could certainly be worse names to be called. Yes. I guess one of the things I've always struggled with sort of the, I guess, modern Buffett approach of buying great businesses and maybe paying up a little for them and holding them for the long term versus sort of more the 50-cent dollar type approach or liquidation value type approach, I suppose. More Ben Graham style is just really the length of time, I guess, that you have to be right for that investment to work out. Like if you pay a high multiple upfront, for example, you really need that growth to turn up for a very long period of time. How do you think about that when you're analyzing a business and as you continue to hold a business, how do you think about whether or not that company continues to meet your criteria to continue to be held and so on?
Well, in my case, I mean, our fund, we're looking for businesses where we do truly feel like they're deep value investments. But modern accounting is very constrained. I mean, the traditional, if you look at a modern business through an old or a traditional accounting lens, you miss 99% of it. I mean, even today, if you look at Google, there's search, the monopolistic value of the search engine is not reflected in the balance sheet. Now it is starting to reflect itself in the income statement, but it's not going to be sitting there as a line item on the balance sheet going, oh, now it's worth, $1 trillion, or now it's worth $500 billion. So you got to put a multiple in that. So first of all, we're looking for businesses where there's significant unrecognized earnings and earning potential based on where the business is going, not where the business has been. So it's not, I don't think you're, at least in our case, we're not just paying up for what we feel is a mature business and just assuming it's going to continue to compound and of taking a very lazy approach of cracking open the earnings call on Cap IQ and slowly reading it at the end of each quarter and being on vacation for the rest of the year. That's not at all what I think this implies. I think what we're doing is we're looking for a situation where where the earnings potential is dramatically undervalued because the market doesn't understand the addressable market that's being created, or the market doesn't understand the competitive advantage of the business and their ability to either create that addressable market or to fill out that addressable market. And so those two things combined are where value is created. And it's not necessarily about tech or not tech. It's just great businesses. That's kind of the trajectory of them. They have a generally an addressable market that's much bigger than people think, and they have a competitive advantage that's much bigger than people think. But there are cases where it's sort of on full display, or we can't understand where the future earning potential is unrecognized, and therefore we would pass, even though it might be a great compounder. We need to feel like we can beat the S&P 500 potentially, at least on an unlevered basis, without trading over like a 3 to 5 year rolling period of time, and even longer. But that's the starting point. So we wouldn't look at a business and say, oh, it trades for this typical whatever multiple of revenue or gross profit or whatever, and you know, we extrapolate that out over so many years and just assume that it's, and discount that back and just assume that it's undervalued. But we're looking for big transitions generally happening in the sector or in the business itself. In many cases have already happened, but the market just doesn't understand the implications of that. And, you know, you can, there are many, many examples that we've used to understand and think about our own process as it's evolved over the years. And we've used examples like Nike, like Starbucks, like Domino's Pizza. So we've also, you know, we've also kind of looked at Google. We've looked at tech companies, medium, big, kind of the whole spectrum. And I think you can apply this framework of investing where there's sizable and recognized earning potential across all kinds of businesses. But you know, I guess going back, looking at some of those great businesses even before the tech kind of boom or modern businesses today, making an investment in Nike, for example, in the 80s, when Phil Knight was making a bet, $500,000 bet on Michael Jordan, you know, the stock was never cheap. The stock was never trading for, you know, 5x free cash flow or something. It was always fully valued relative to interest rates at the time. Actually, it was probably overvalued for most of its existence if you had a short-term time horizon. But the more you zoomed out and the more you studied what was actually happening, which was the creation of the addressable market for athletic apparel, as mass adoption of people wearing tennis shoes and jerseys and kind of adopting you know, athletic apparel as kind of mainstream. If you sort of saw that and saw what was actually happening, I think you could have started to see that, well, this isn't just your average tennis shoe company. This isn't just a guy gambling necessarily without any kind of, without a purpose on an athlete like Michael Jordan. Yes, there was some luck involved, but in order to capture that long tail opportunity in Nike starting in the 80s, you would have had to have been comfortable studying where the business is going and have it creating your own matrix to measure that progress. And you would have needed to pretty much ignore the valuation at that time, which again, no matter how you looked at it, was expensive, very expensive relative to interest rates. So you can say that about, I mean, that's the story of every successful business when you go back, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 years from when Buffett invested in Coca-Cola to Geico Insurance, which is where Ben Graham, you know, apparently made the vast, vast majority of all his net worth, was in the high growth, long-term compounder, which was Geico. And that was benefiting from enormous macro tailwinds of adoption of vehicles and the home after, you know, post-World War II era in North America, et cetera. So, yeah, it's not just buy and hold any business. It's really coming to a strong conviction around why this company will be worth substantially more in the future, and where is that misunderstood? And that generally comes down to addressable market and competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm. One of the I guess markets that is expanding at the moment, or where the total addressable market is expanding at the moment, is the creator economy. And I know you've got some investments, or at least one investment through Spotify, I think. Touching that space. Did you want to speak maybe to how you think about that particular market and what you think the market might be missing there?
Well, Spotify, yes, the creator economy is exploding. I'm not sure if anybody that can create a podcast or make a song is necessarily going to be successful. I mean, I think our investment in Spotify is more about the monetization of the attention that they command, that's and a real, what we feel is a real misunderstanding of the addressable market for audio and the competitive advantage that Spotify has. to continue to grow that and monetize the attention that their subscribers have. So there's kind of a short, medium, and long tail opportunity with Spotify. It does, you know, it is, it's never really traded like a tech stock, first of all. So it's never really been a quote unquote high flyer. It's never traded for 20 or 30 times revenue or 50 times revenue. I think it trades for more or less, you know, three, four times revenue, next year's revenue, something like that, forward revenue. And it's because the business is seen as just a streaming business, a music streaming business that has a lot of competition and will never be able to get out and, underneath the thumb of the labels. And that couldn't be further from reality. And I think that probably was a reality, you know, 10 years ago or even 6 or 7 years ago. But the business is a search and discovery business. Just like you would think of Google as a search and discovery tool. Well, Spotify is a similar type of business in audio. And what we think is that they are building tools that allow owners of content to unlock potential that just wasn't there before. And the first example of that is through advertising, podcast advertising, which is, we think, worth, you know, putting a decent multiple or an average multiple on where we think the average ad revenue will be in the next 3 or 4 years is probably worth more than the market cap of the entire company today. But that's longer term, though. We think that there will be a that there's an enormous opportunity to create for creators to make money besides just, you know, streaming their music and playing concerts and then, you know, on the audio side, on the podcast and audiobook side, it's just extremely under monetized area of the internet with a lot of attention. And there's nobody better at that than Spotify. You know, there's a lot of other facets to the business that we're interested in. I mean, it's not a, it's kind of gone the opposite way of the walled garden. It benefits from a kind of a Web 3.0 environment, or you know, the explosion of if NFTs actually do take off, and that's an opportunity for creators to make money. It benefits from all that through search and discovery, through filtering of content. So, yeah, we just think it's kind of ridiculous that a major artist, even like let's call it U2 or Bruce Springsteen, isn't worth more. And it's the reason their estates and their brands are not worth more is because we haven't had an ability to monetize. They haven't had an ability to monetize those super fans globally outside of concerts and streaming, and that's. That should just represent a small fraction of what they're actually worth. You know, somebody like Bruce Springsteen should, you know, make more money selling Jeeps and I you know, I've said this before to other investors and other people thinking about Spotify, that somebody like Bruce Springsteen should be able to make more money selling Jeeps and boots and leather jackets and tequila and or whiskey, multitudes more than he probably can streaming. I mean, so as that ability to identify the super fan through Spotify evolves, and artists, whether it's a podcast host or whether it's a musician, learn what to do with that and how to interact with that super fan. I think you're going to see, you know, outside of just traditional advertising, I think you're going to see some really interesting business models. To being built on top of that data to monetize that, especially with, you know, as more and more content is produced and more content potentially is owned, you know, through NFTs or the smart contracts.
How
So
far
it's interesting.
ahead is Spotify in helping creators and musicians and so on to monetize versus other streaming platforms?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. I mean, the company today is completely different than it was a year ago. It doesn't look anything like it. And I think in 2 or 3 years, it'll look completely different as well. I mean, today, you go to an artist's page, and you'll see a merch bar where it's connected to their Shopify account. So you can buy Lady Gaga garb that wasn't even available 6 months ago. And I think connecting the whole audio ecosystem and interaction with the fan is also very, very new. So having an invite to a pre-concert event was for the super fans that maybe they pay for. Having an invite to a and that could be through, through live audio, through like the Green Room app. In the future, sending a push notification to take advantage of something you've signed up for as part of a fan club or a fan group. I don't see that happening on any other platform, to be honest. I mean, when you I don't go to especially YouTube Music. I mean, I feel like I'm the most critical of YouTube Music. And Apple Music is really, in my view, not even a competitor anymore. They have many, many other things on their plate. So the opportunity has been kind of created by Spotify. The interaction, the identification of the super fan, and then monetizing it it's somewhat early stage, but I don't see anybody that's made remotely the progress that they have. Like I said, there was an announcement just a month ago that now Shopify is going to allow their users to mint and sell NFTs. And guess what? They're connected to Spotify. So if example, Bruce Springsteen or U2 wanted to sell an NFT that had something to do with a special golden ticket, or wanted to raise money for the rainforest or a political cause or whatever they want to do. You invent the model. You invent the opportunity. Just, I mean, I don't, it's not Spotify's role to tell these people how they're going to make money. They just give them the tools to do so in an environment that is not a closed ecosystem. And it's also an environment where Spotify does not need to own the music content because they don't own it now, and they don't necessarily benefit in a future world where content ownership is potentially more, more fragmented. So, yes, as of right this second, I think it is new to be able to go to Lady Gaga's page and buy her merch on Spotify. But I think it's not only about selling merchandise, but it's about the creating more interaction and stimulating more interaction with that particular artist or with that particular podcast host, and then monetizing and finding ways to monetize that, which it may sound a little bit pie in the sky, but I think if you look at, it's incredible that for given how much time we spend listening to podcasts that podcast hosts like yourself aren't able to monetize, for example, the attention of whoever is listening to this right now. There should be a world where, and where Spotify is going is with dynamic ad insertion, there should be a world where the advertiser, wants to buy the listener, and building that personality profile on that listener is where the value is. So if a podcast host wants to monetize and somebody, with a profile that looks like they could spend more on, I don't know, some other advertising, some other service is in the UK, for example, listening, it shouldn't matter what that person in the UK is listening to. It should matter per se. It should be, hey, we can buy that user. I want to buy 100,000 middle-aged men in Russia. Okay, you should be able to buy and target those people to sell something specific. So I think that's sort of where it's going in the medium term on the ad side. But longer term, there is an enormous opportunity as music goes online and streaming goes online. First of all, to disintermediate radio, and then to allow creators, whoever they are or whatever their size, to find ways to make money from that audience. Yeah, I mean, we look at Spotify as one of the best pure play audio search engines available. And we think it's only getting more and more interesting as time goes on. both from a financial perspective, but also from, you know, long-term, long-tail business opportunity.
Gotcha. And maybe switching gears slightly, and this doesn't have to be Spotify as the example, but any stock really. I mean, you're taking a very long-term view of these investments, and I was reading through the slide deck for your fund, and one of the things that I thought was super interesting that kind of jumped off the page at me is this concept of the pain index. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, to make a long-term investment is probably the reason is probably the loneliest strategy in the public market world is because it requires being able to absorb a lot of pain. You know, investors all say they want long-term. They all say they're long-term and they can withstand, you know, down markets, whatever. But the truth is when you run a concentrated portfolio and you're never really going to be, you're not a proxy for the market. You know, our fund, I mean, our top five positions are, you know, 60, 70% of the fund, sometimes more than that. So, they're going to be volatile and they're not always going to be in favor. So in the slide deck, we show examples of companies that we've used, to develop our own, you know, develop our lens and our process. And it's just interesting to see how those companies have performed over the last 20 or 25 years, like a Nike that I mentioned, or like a Domino's Pizza, and how many periods of time that they were down 25, 30, 50%. So you can't capture the long tail opportunity of an Apple, for example, unless you're able to withstand long periods of being down a lot. And I've come to appreciate the, like Greenspan talked about, the physical pain that people feel when their portfolio is down a lot because they feel like they've lost something. They feel like they can't get it back. And that's especially difficult when the greater market is going the opposite direction. But you can see how difficult it actually is to do because, you know, you how many people do you know that have owned that, you know, so many people could have owned Apple over the last 30 years, and so many people have owned Apple over the last 30 or 25 years, let's call it. But what percentage of those people have continuously held it as an actual position, not a 1% flyer? But how many people that you know have owned Apple over the last investment funds, older people, retirement funds, nonprofit organizations, institutions, you name it? Of course, they've owned it off and on over the last 20, 25 years, but how many of them have held it and captured, you know, that gain of more than 100,000%? The same with Netflix, the same with any successful investment. And so our investment process is built around how do we look at these companies? How do we monitor these companies a way that allows us to have a shot at achieving that long tail and not be forced to sell it because, you know, for the wrong reasons. We don't mind selling it for the right reasons, but we need to, if we see that business progress happening and unfolding every year, and the valuation not getting so out of control, and still looking cheap relative to our outlook over the next and rolling next 3 years, 5 years, et cetera, then we want to keep owning it. But in order to do so requires a lot of pain. So you can't name a successful stock investment that hasn't been through enormous amounts of pain. And like they say, no pain, no gain.
I like it. Yeah, I was actually this is an investor who unfortunately isn't a real person, but I rewatched one of my favorite movies the other night, which happens to be Forrest Gump, and towards the end of the movie he gets the letter about an investment in some fruit company, right? And I think if you actually
Yes.
read the letter, it's dated 1975, which is actually I think at least 1 year, maybe 2 years before Apple was even founded. But if he'd held on from 1975 through to today, that would have done some pretty spectacular things.
Yeah, Yeah, and you know, I'll note that there's a lot of ways to make money in the stock market. And making a long-term investment or thinking about a stock like you're buying the whole company is definitely not for everybody. I mean, there's very successful people that just focus on short selling or macro, or they trade a lot. It just depends on your personality. And I don't think the way we do it is by any means necessarily superior or better to someone else. It's just more of a fit for my personality. I'm interested in those, in trading less and focusing on the business rather than the market, and really getting deep into a business and understanding in a way that it allows us to have the conviction to own it when others can't. I like the businesses we own. I would, I ask myself, would I want to work at that company, that we own? A lot of times in the past we have owned less desirable companies and more financially driven, short-term driven things and special situations, which we're not above doing. But we look out, I mean, our fund is the Survivor and Thriver Fund. So we look out and what's the right, we look out at kind of what are the best opportunities that we can find, that we can focus on, that we can understand over the next 3, 5, 10 years. And I look at our investor base, which are basically a group of families. That are investing multi-generational capital. We feel like it's just the right, it's a fit. It feels right to me to invest like that. But that's again, not everybody's brain works the same way.
Yeah, fair call. And when you do own, a highly concentrated portfolio of stocks that you plan to own for a long time, or businesses you plan to own for a long time, I mean, what does a typical day look like for you? Is it spent researching current holdings? Are you looking into new holdings? Are you heading off to the beach? What's
No,
happening?
it's generally it's a good question because I think a lot of people have this vision of a hedge fund manager sitting in front of a Bloomberg terminal, very nervous, waiting for the market to open, looking at red and green flashes on their screen. Maybe there's four screens, being irritable. So our day, I mean, I have a my partner Seth and I, we normally sometimes it's some we'll go through periods where we're really focusing on one or two companies, and other periods where we're just sort of like, well, let's just study these sectors again. Let's look at the competitors again. Let's go back and understand what's going on. I mean, for example, we've got three ad tech investments, and so ad tech as a sector is just an incredible sector. It's a very fast moving sector. It's a very disruptive sector. It's full of winners and losers. Today's winner might be tomorrow's loser, et cetera. And there's a lot of public companies to follow. There's a lot of private companies to follow. There's a lot of venture-backed companies to follow. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of people to talk to. And then the implications of the ra a rapidly changing ad tech landscape proliferate throughout traditional businesses as well. And so you can spend time kind of repeeling the onion back of just one sector all day, all week, all month, all year. I mean, it's there's just kind of an endless opportunity to research and read and think. And so that's kind of what it is. Every day, I mean, Spotify, right? Spotify covers multiple industries. It's not just music, but it's podcast, it's creator economy, it's ad tech. It's also payments. In a way, it just covers so many things. And there's a lot of people you can interview. We try to talk to people that, service providers to these companies that are providing some kind of, whether it's attribution analysis, whether it's somebody providing, I don't know, just important inputs into what we think are going to be translate longer term into earnings growth to that business. Sometimes it's talking to customers. Like for example, with Roku, we first started studying the business. We didn't fully appreciate the value opportunity for a content owner, And so we set out to learn and speak to content owners, like people that there's people that own, there's a whole world of people that own a small library of content, whether it's reality shows. I mean, not all television and TV content is owned by, you know, the top two or three studios. And so we set out, we spent a long time. We're still in contact with some of them. Hey, how does it work? How do you make money? How has it evolved over time? You used to sell into, you know, you used to have a 5-year deal with a cable network, and now you're basically splitting an ad share and you're paying Roku, and you're splitting the ad, you know, the ad revenue. Is that better or worse than how it was before? What's it like doing the same with YouTube, for example? There's just, you know, it seems like, you know, yeah, if you're not studying the market itself, that there's not a lot to do. But actually, if you're looking at a business, like you own the company, it's actually an enormous amount to do. So that's what gets us excited, especially me, because I like the businesses we own a lot. And I do see over time that we have built, it doesn't necessarily always translate to outperformance. Sometimes it can translate to dramatic underperformance, but I clearly do see the advantage and the conviction that you can build through that type of approach compared to a traditional financial mind that just maybe modeling it out based on past numbers and layering on, kind of extrapolating the past into the future and trying to come up with some EBITDA target. And that to me is, you know, the idea of understanding a business that intimately is how I, you know, enjoy spending my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. And presumably that helps with sort of the pain index example, right? If you understand these businesses very deeply, it makes it much easier to hold than if you just had a simple spreadsheet doing a DCF or something.
Yeah, I can't even imagine, you know, with some of our, we tell our investors, expect, and in our presentation, we say, expect every stock we own to go down 50% at least once during the time in which we own it. I can't imagine if you didn't really understand what you owned, there's no way a traditional fund could hang on to something going down 50, 60, 70%. Even if that was, for example, March 2020, even if you felt whether it has to do with the way the company is perceived or the industry or the overall macro, you really have to have that conviction to be able to hang on for the ride, because when it happens, it's never going to feel good. It's always going to be uncomfortable. And yeah, you need to have something to hang on to other than headlines, because the headlines are terrible, because the other people also are not, they don't have conviction in the business either. They haven't, most of them haven't done the work. So that's what they hang on to. They Google around and look for people doing write-ups and on Seeking Alpha and, oh, this is a bad company, sell it, or I told you so, or it's overvalued, or oh my God, they'll never be able to overcome this, or there's a dispute here, or there's a lawsuit there, and if you haven't gone deep, you can't hang on. And so over time, that inability to hang on will cost you. I think almost inevitably it guarantees that you can't beat the market over a really long period of time, which is, you know, why most funds can't beat the S&P 500 over 20, 30 years. And it's very, very few that can. And I don't know how we will turn out. I mean, we're 10 years old, but I don't know. Let's see how the next 20 years, I think it gets harder and harder as the fund ages, but I at least want to position us to have a shot at doing it. And you don't get there by churning over the portfolio because there's, you know, certain sectors are out of favor, or there's a rotation between this and this, or something like that. You're never going to understand your next, you know, like they say, your 10th and 12th and 15th best idea cannot mathematically be as good as your first best idea and your second best idea.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree more. One of the other things I want to chat to you about a little bit here is this idea of living uncomfortably. It's something you mentioned to me the first time we spoke.
Yeah.
Do you want to share some of your thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, I think it's I think to be a good investor requires finding a way to live very uncomfortably. I don't think it's the best investments are generally, you're always worried. You're always worried that they're overvalued. You're always worried that you're missing something because people are throwing tomatoes at you most of the time. Whether you go back to Amazon in 2012, where people really were convicted, all the way up to some of the biggest hedge fund managers who are famous for shorting it, like David Einhorn, for example, versus other managers who have now become famous for holding Amazon and making it a large position. So it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to be different. It's uncomfortable to take the other side and say, no, I think you're wrong. No, I think it doesn't really matter what discount rate you use. If you look out 5 or 6 years, this thing is worth, 20x more potentially. At minimum, it's 5x more because of these things. That's if you look at the like Netflix, for example, going back to 2011, how hard would it have been in 2011, 2012 to own Netflix? Turns out the Netflix is one of the cheapest companies in the entire stock market going back to that quick. Could you imagine being able to buy Netflix for 5 or 6 billion valuation? But to do that required you to look past the traditional like accounting lens. It required you to go really deep into the business as if you owned the business, as if you were partnered with Reed Hastings and saw his vision, and then develop your own KPIs to measure that short-term progress and stitch it all together. And that is very uncomfortable because it goes against the way Wall Street thinks. It goes against the mainstream. It goes against the markets. It goes against very successful older people that are just on talk, the talking heads on CNBC that are just always constantly bearish. It goes against the way people raise money, for example, in finance. I mean, money is ra the business of finance, whether it's financial advice or whether it's raising money for a hedge fund, is generally fear driven. So it's, people raise money through selling fear. And so it's uncomfortable to be the guy saying, no, I'm not fearful at all. I'm actually really excited. I'm super excited about this. God, look at guys, look what they're doing. Look how far along they are. The market doesn't understand. And yes, you have to peel it back. And yes, we could all get hit by a car and die tomorrow, but wow, this is actually there's an enormous margin of safety that doesn't show up on the balance sheet. And look how exciting this is. And I think, yeah, it does require an element of feeling of being uncomfortable and living uncomfortable. We have gone through periods recently where some stocks just are up like 1% every day, it felt. I mean, there's some big, and I don't need to name the names, but there's been some large caps over the last, year or two that doesn't matter. You get up in the morning, it's up 1%. Now maybe that's changed the last 3 months, but life isn't supposed to be that easy, And it's great that if you had owned those businesses when they were really difficult to own, and you're now just capturing like what I referred to as maybe more the long tail. But I think just chasing that momentum to try to make yourself feel better. Is a fool's game if you're a long-term investor. So we learn how to just live uncomfortably, and I think that's what investors are paying us for. They're paying us to understand these companies to the best of our ability, as best we can for being on the outside and not being on the inside of them. And I think they're paying us to shield that burden and to when they go down to feel it. And keep scrubbing the business and go back to the thesis and say, God, do we get it right or is this just temporary?
Do you think that mental framework is something that can sort of be learned, or do you think this is a personality trait where you've always been comfortable being uncomfortable?
If you're going to be a long-term investor, I mean, I don't know if it's more of a chicken and egg question, I guess. When I've over the years, I've invested different ways. I mean, when we first started, it was more special situations, distressed, microcaps, you know, going back to 2010, 2011. When I didn't know, I wasn't the investor that I am today. I was more accounting oriented and put a model together and say, oh, this company's trading for 6 times or 5 times free cash flow. And if it was sold in a private transaction, it would trade for 8. And so we're going to hold it till that spread closes. And that's a great way to start, I guess. But it doesn't allow you to, and so there's this, I guess going back to that, there's this artificial feeling of there's of that, well, you know, that you're right, and because the numbers say you're right, and there's a margin of safety there, so it just doesn't matter what happens. But then it puts you in a position to where you're constantly having to trade and sell those things the second they hit that what you think is this full value, and then going out and finding another investment. And so with for my personality and looking at the kind of fund I wanted to build, which was a place where families could make long-term investments and compound multi-generational capital, that type of investing, you know, trading, rotating in and out of things just didn't seem like a match for somebody saying, look, I've got, you know, tens of millions more than I need. And this is for my kids, and so we want to maximize that return without taking on a lot of, you know, without using leverage, for example, by making intelligent long-term investments in businesses where we wouldn't have access to these incredible CEOs and these incredible opportunities otherwise. I mean, you want to invest in Daniel Ek, you buy Spotify. I mean, you find a situation like him where, you know, he's you can't it'd be you'd be hard pressed to find a CEO more aligned with the common shareholder than him. I mean, you saw it similar with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, for example, when he was running Microsoft. I mean, he wasn't taking a big salary. I think it was a dollar or something. You know, if you want that, the way I felt that I wanted to build a firm for those types of investors, people with long-term time horizons, like I said, and not fast money, not people trying to, you know, we were interested in this mindset of starting over again at the beginning of each year. We wanted to compound our knowledge, wanted to compound our own acumen. And, you know, it's really hard to do that if you are trading around short-term valuations all the time and trading around market noise. And so as we evolved, it was like, oh my gosh, we're actually missing out. Not only are we missing out on the long tail by trading things, but we're also not really aligning ourselves with you know with the kind of business that we're not maximizing, we're not compounding, we're not maximizing our intellectual knowledge. We're not maximizing our own, you know, our own the knowledge that we're creating ourselves, our own intellectual property. So that's sort of why I think this is a fit for us, but maybe not a fit for everybody, this approach.
I like it. I like that. Yeah, it's I think we discussed this on our previous call, but yeah, there are lots of ways to make money in the stock market, but it's kind of useless to have a strategy that can make money if it doesn't fit your personality and you can't implement it right.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I would rather, you know, most of our mistakes, if I look back from the beginning, have been around selling a company. And I think that's probably true for most investors. Everybody has this story of, oh my gosh, I sold XYZ amazing company because of whatever reason. And it generally was not because you needed the money, it was because you thought it was overvalued, or you were basically fearful, or you didn't have that conviction in the business to continue holding it. And I would rather, you know, if you're going to make a mistake and you're going to make mistakes and you're going to fight some battles. So the battle we would rather fight and the mistakes we would rather make are around holding a business too long and not selling it than the mistake of missing out on, especially if you're going to own high quality businesses or great companies, I would rather make the mistake of, wow, we should have probably sold that, versus, oh my God, if we would have only held any of these companies that we sold, you know, that we would have kind of blown the doors off. So it just depends on what battle you want to fight internally too.
I like it. Look, I know you need to get going, Jeremy, shortly. But one last topic I wanted to chat to you about is actually the guy who connected us, who happens to be called Guy Spear.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how you met Guy and how you know him.
I know Guy through Matt Peterson. Matt Peterson, maybe 7 years ago, read his book, wrote him a nice note, and Guy wrote him back apparently and invited him to his event ValueX, which is an annual event in Clusters. And I think Matt called and said, Matt Peterson called me and said, hey, do you have any interest in going to this? You know, I don't want to go by myself. And I said, yeah, I'd love to go to, I mean, I had heard of Guy through Monish, and Monish had talked about him and mentioned him. And, I guess he wrote Guy back and said, hey, can I bring a friend? And Guy said, sure. So Matt and I went to ValueX together in Clusters, and it was just an incredible experience. And that's where I met Guy. And then the relationship evolved over time. And he's been a mentor of mine. We talk regularly now. And, you know, one of the things he, when I moved to Europe 5 years ago, he really encouraged me to think about this idea of there are places in the world that are best for different times in your life. So there's no perfect place, and there's no perfect place to live, but there are places that are better for different periods in your life. There are places that are great for when you're in your 20s. There are places to live that are great when you're retired. And then there's places that are great to raise a family. And his thought process to how he came to the conclusion to move to Zurich, and he's not Swiss, was something that really stuck with me and helped me think through, you know, my move to Europe. Yeah, he's been a great mentor. His framework is incredible for thinking about, you know, investing and just people that he wants to surround himself with. And yeah, he's an inspiration of mine, and I'm very grateful for the, you know, to have him in my life.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Guy as well. I actually just reread his book probably 2 or 3 months ago, I think. And yeah, that's one of my favorite investing books. I feel as though some of the things you've spoken about on this podcast might be starting to rub off on Guy. After some recent interviews I've seen with him, he's talking about, you know, off balance sheet value and you know, most traditional value metrics and value traps and all these things. I feel like you might be starting to influence.
Well, I don't know if it's me. You know, it started with there's a book, Helman Helmer's Seven Powers, which talks about what make a company great, which basically boil down to competitive advantage and addressable market. And he was a famous early Netflix investor. And Guy and I have talked quite a bit about that book. And there's another book called, and maybe screwing this up, called Capitalism Without Capital. And Bill Gates had recommended it. And it's about the dramatic shortcomings of traditional accounting, modern, you know, accounting, gap accounting in a modern business where a lot of the equity is intangible. So where accounting falls short for thinking about how to value a company. And so in the old days, you had to buy a piece of equipment and put it on the balance sheet, and there was the return you could make on that, and you basically started making after tax profit from day one. And today, there's so many businesses that don't need to pay tax because they have such a long runway. They have such a long runway to continue to reinvest at a high rate of return that they may not pay tax for the next 10 years. And so you have to find another way of looking at them. And it doesn't mean that they're not really profitable at the unit economic level. Like, unit economics can be just gushing cash flow. And but that also doesn't mean that just because a company is growing a lot, that you know, just doesn't mean, that doesn't mean you sort of ignore the accounting. But yeah, I think the traditional screening for a business is sort of, unless you're just in the business of investing in old or mature to dying businesses, I think then it makes more sense, or if you're a leveraged investor. But yeah, capital without, or capitalism without capital, great book, and Seven Powers as well. So as time goes on, you'll probably see more and more companies where there's a mismatch between what gap accounting is able to show and what's being created at the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll have to check those out. And I think that's a fantastic place to wrap it up. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Jeremy. Just one final thing. If people want to check out more from you or follow along with what you're doing, is there anywhere that they can go to do that?
Yeah, we have our investor presentation on our website, jdpcap.com. And there's a little form you can fill out. And if you're an accredited investor, you can sign up to receive our quarterly updates and fact sheet, et cetera. So yeah, jdpcap.com, and or just send me a message through that. And yeah, I'd love to hear from anybody that's interested in talking more about this stuff.
Great. I will leave that link down in the description if people are watching this on YouTube, and in the show notes if you're listening on a podcast platform, perhaps Spotify. So really appreciate your time, Jeremy. We'll have to do this again one day.
Sounds good. Thank you for your time.